From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a question, answer, and insult session with Gene Simmons, the bassist of the rock group Kiss. The band is known for garish black and white makeup, 8-inch platform heels, and outrageous stage shows in which Simmons spits blood, breathes fire, and waves his 7-inch tongue. Also, we talk with Mark Weber, a young actor who stars in the new Todd Solondz film Storytelling. Weber's mother is a homeless activist in Philadelphia, and he was homeless during part of his childhood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A Senate committee will subpoena former Enron CEO Kenneth Lay to appear next week. Lay had been scheduled to testify today but pulled out late yesterday. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
The Senate Commerce Committee plans to send a subpoena to Lay on Tuesday, requiring he come to Congress next week. Lawmakers acknowledge Lay may well say nothing, as he is allowed to do under constitutional protection against self-incrimination. But senators say only top company executives know the answers to many of the questions surrounding Enron. Chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, Ernest Hollings, is calling for a special counsel to investigate the company's collapse.
The Attorney General himself has recused himself. Now he's given it to Larry Thompson, and Larry Thompson is from the law firm that represented both Enron and Anderson. So I don't think there should be any connection. In other words, it should be independent.
In response to Hollings' suggestion, the Department of Justice says there's no need for a special counsel to investigate Enron. Emily Harris, NPR News, Washington.
Kenneth Lay announced today that he has resigned from the Enron board because of the inquiries and investigations that are focused on him personally. Lay resigned his position as chairman and CEO of the company 2 weeks ago. President Bush sent his budget proposal to Congress today, including big increases in funding for the military and homeland security, along with cuts in many domestic programs. The total budget comes to $2.1 trillion, up nearly 4% from last year. Its proposals to increase military spending by $48 billion and homeland defense by nearly $40 billion were generally well received on Capitol Hill. The homeland defense money would go for items such as increased security on the Canadian border, improved firefighting equipment, and improved anthrax testing. The World Economic Forum concluded its 5-day meeting in New York today. Amy Eddings reports from member station WNYC.
The forum's final sessions were centered around corporate management issues. In one workshop, top executives at AOL Time Warner and Cisco Systems strongly supported more corporate accountability for social issues such as poverty. But Financial Times writer Martin Wolf received applause when he argued that it was inappropriate to hold private businesses to the same accountability as elected political leaders. Meanwhile, non-governmental organizations such as Oxfam and Human Rights Watch said their concerns are being discussed at this year's forum as never before. They credited anti-globalization protesters with that. Those protests continued with demonstrations against Enron and against the economic policies that activists say contributed to the crisis in Argentina. For NPR News, I'm Amy Eddings in New York.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 220 points or 2.2%. They closed at 9,687 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 55 points and closed at 1,855. This is NPR News. Two factions in northern Afghanistan are reported to be ready to withdraw from the city of Mazar-e-Sharif. The withdrawal would reduce tensions in the city where rival factions have maintained heavily armed fighters. A spokesman for one of the factions says the leaders will form a joint security force. As U.S. pressure builds on Iraq, Saddam Hussein has sent a message to the United Nations saying his country is ready to reopen a dialogue with no preconditions. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
According to a UN spokesman, the Secretary General of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, carried Saddam's message to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Annan responded, saying he's ready to receive a delegation from Iraq to discuss the implementation of relevant Security Council resolutions. No date has been set, and there's no word on exactly what the Iraqis are willing to discuss. The United Nations has demanded that weapons inspectors be allowed back into the country. In his State of the Union speech, President Bush made clear he won't stand by while countries like Iraq develop weapons of mass destruction. Those comments again raise speculation that Iraq may be targeted in the war on terrorism. Iraq, meantime, has sent delegations to Europe and to Arab nations and has promised to allow a visit by a UN human rights investigator. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
So far, there's no further information on the fate of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who's been kidnapped in Pakistan. Pakistan's interior minister said today that the FBI has joined in the search for Pearl, who was captured nearly 2 weeks ago. Investigators say they have established that a body dumped yesterday near the city of Karachi is not that of Pearl. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saab, presenting the 2002 all-new 9.5 sedan and sport wagon with the power of turbo. Information and dealer locator at saabusa.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gene Simmons, is the fire-breathing, blood-spitting, tongue-wagging bass player of the heavy metal band Kiss. Nearly 30 years since their first recording, they still sell out when they tour the world. When Kiss started performing in the 70s, the band became famous for its look as well as its music. They paint their faces in bold black and white patterns that seem inspired by comic book superheroes and villains. They also dress outrageously in wardrobes that include giant platform shoes, breastplates, and cod pieces. The band has been the subject of comic books and movies and has had all kinds of merchandising tie-ins. Now Gene Simmons has a best-selling memoir called Kiss and Makeup. Gene Simmons is his stage name. He was born in Israel in 1949, the son of a Holocaust survivor. When he was 10, he moved with his mother to Queens, New York. There he dropped his Hebrew name and became Gene Klein. Gene Simmons, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with the makeup. Did you like being covered up on stage? Did it make you feel any less vulnerable or any less like Gene Simmons or your other names, Gene Klein or Chaim Weitz, which was your birth name?
Close but no guitars. It's Chaim Witz.
Oh, thanks. Okay.
You said it. The name came out through Gentile mouth, so it didn't quite have the flavor. It came out bland.
Well, it's not a Gentile mouth.
Ooh. Maybe it's a discussion we can have.
Okay.
But let's not start something we're not going to finish.
Right.
But in terms of the, what was the question about makeup?
Oh, did you like being covered up by makeup, and did it make you feel less vulnerable or, you know, less like Gene Simmons, Gene Klein, or your birth name?
I don't feel covered up any more or less than any girl feels covered up when she wears makeup. The makeup is simply an extension of a personality, and colors, clothing, makeup all express something. And getting up on stage was a chance to sort of live out the, sort of a scream therapy meets a rock and roll band version. I wanted to put together the band I never saw on stage. I wanted to be in a band that gave bang for the buck. I wanted to be in a band that didn't look like a bunch of guys who, you know, should be in a library studying for their finals. You know, I wanted stars up on stage. And regular people just didn't look big enough. So we wore 8-inch platform heels, put on more makeup and higher heels than your mother, and made more money than your banker. See, it all kind of works out.
Did you pattern your makeup on comic book heroes?
My makeup came as a result of a lot of things, all things Americana. Godzilla, horror movies, science fiction, Black Bolt, which was an Inhumans Marvel comic book, and science fiction, certainly. So it's comic books, all things sort of American pop culture. The rest of the guys in the band had different notions. Paul put on the red lips and the star over his eye as a kind of a exaggeration of what he thought a rock star was, because he always wanted to be a rock star. I was never interested in being a rock star. I always wanted to be Boris Karloff. And Ace, who's the spaceman in the group, has delusions of grandeur, and perhaps gravity doesn't quite affect him in the same way, which is to say that he doesn't have good equilibrium which is a big word, come to think of it, just like gymnasium. This is NPR. That's why we're using big words.
How would you describe the pattern on your face?
A banker's pattern. When you look at it, it says, boy, that guy's got a lot of money. You know why I'm pulling your leg? Because I can't touch it from where I am. This is a serious kind of...
Well, we'll get to that a little later.
Yeah, I'm not going
to
play
we'll
the
tally game a little
because
later.
Because this is all, after all, it means very little. I'm in a weird band. We've done very well. The American dream is alive and well. And in terms of what it all means, it's sort of academic, really. It's about two guys from the intelligentsia, which is not the intelligence service, who sit around and sort of contemplate their navel. At the end of the day, it means nothing. At the end of the day, food tastes good. I like it or I don't like it. And kiss, yeah, I like him or I don't like him. That's a conversation, and it's never-ending. But what you can't argue with is the American notion, which is of the people, for the people, by the people. They vote with money. You and I, we sit here and we just talk and toss the ball around. That doesn't mean a lot.
Are you trying to say to me that all that matters to you is money?
I will contend, and you try to disprove it, that the most important thing as we know it on this planet and this plane is, in fact, money. You want me to prove it?
Go ahead.
The first thing you need besides air, which so far is free, and by the way, if you went scuba diving, you're paying for air. The other thing besides that is food. It's what we need to survive. I don't know what other tool I would use besides money to buy it. Although, as a woman, of course, you have the ability to sell your body, then get the money, and then with that, get food. But ultimately, money is part of it.
You are weird.
Really? How do you get food?
Well, not by selling my body, but...
But that's a choice you have that I don't. But getting to the money part, money is the single most important thing on the planet, including the notion that love gives you everything. It's a load of hogwash, because although I subscribe to the romantic notion of life...
Well, let's get to the chase. How much money do you have?
Gee, a lot more than NPR.
Well, I know. You're very defensive on money, aren't you?
No, I'm not. I'm actually just trying to show you that there's a big world out there, and reading books is wonderful. I've certainly read, well, perhaps as many as you have, but there's a delusional kind of notion that runs rampant in...
Wait, could we just get something straight?
Of course.
I'm not here to prove that I'm smart, and
not
I'm not
you.
Here to prove that you're not smart or that you don't read books
not,
or can't make a lot of money.
This is not about you. You're being very defensive. Why are you doing that?
It's contagious.
Yeah.
Can we get back to your makeup? What do you use to paint your face, and do you ever break out from it?
No, it's actually oil-based. It's Stein's makeup is one of the brand names, but you can use lots of things. I don't think I've ever been asked that question, but no, my skin is more beautiful than yours. I would be quite more popular in jail if I so chose.
What do you do to take the makeup off? What do you use?
You use Pond's. You know, the same stuff women do, or you can use a Stein's concoction, which is, you know, sort of similar but more industrious. Industrial. Industrious means sort of ambitious. Industrial in strength.
Now, clothes that you've worn on stage include fishnet stockings, spike platform
That's
boots.
Actually untrue.
No?
Better research needed. Fire your research person. No fishnet stockings, never. Not in this band.
Oh, I'm sure I saw you.
We catch fish with fishnets.
I was sure I saw you in them. But that's all right. I trust you. I trust you on that.
Don't ever do that. I'm a man.
No, let's get to the studded cod piece. Do you have a sense of humor about that? I mean, does that seem funny to you or you?
No, it holds in my manhood. Otherwise,
right.
It would be too much for you to take. You'd have to put the book down and confront life. The notion is that if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you're also going to have to welcome me with open legs.
That's a really obnoxious thing to say.
No, it's not. Why should I say something behind your back that I can't tell you to your face?
Wait, has it come to this? Is this the only way that you can talk to a woman, to do that shtick?
Let me ask you something. Why is it shtick when all women have ever wanted, ever since we've crawled out of caves, is why can't a man just tell me the truth and just speak to me plainly? So if I do that, you can't have it both ways.
So you really have no sense of humor about this, do you?
Oh, I'm laughing all the way. You know,
to the bank, right?
Well, of course. Don't I sound like a happy guy?
Not really, to be honest with you.
I was going to suggest you get outside of the musty place where you can count the dust particles falling around you and get out in the world and see what everybody else is doing.
Having sex with you?
Well, if you chose, but you'd have to stand in line.
Well, that's the thing. We might as well get to this since you keep bringing it up. Yeah, you've had 4,000...
I didn't, actually. You did.
You write in your book you've had 4,600 sexual liaisons over the years.
You're supposed to say so far.
So far.
Right.
To you, this will be asking the obvious, but why have you wanted so many encounters?
I can only spell it in three letters, M-A-N. When a woman, and look, I'm not here to say that I'm a scientist or pretend or portend to be anything else. Those are semantics, of course, but then neither you nor I are anti-semantic. The notion is plain, and I read a book called Myth of Monogamy, which actually sort of approached the subject and verbalized it. And I finally understood what it was, because every woman suspects that the man she's laying next to is not necessarily going to be, well, faithful is the word. And privately, she tells her girlfriends, oh, God, all men are dogs. You're correct. And I'm here to tell you that in my deluded perspective, perhaps, it's biological. The first, quote, man and women, if man was predisposed to be monogamous, and we all lived in caves at that point, there were one or two alpha males and the rest were females. Either way, if we were monogamous within one or two generations, we would all be cross-eyed and retarded. Get it?
My guest is Gene Simmons, the bass player of Kiss. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gene Simmons, the bass player of the heavy metal band Kiss. He has a new memoir called Kiss and Makeup. So let me ask this. You say you've had sex with about 4,600 people, women.
Women, yes.
You actually count? I mean, do you have like a book in which you, know, you I, you keep know, hash I never marks paid, for?
I never paid much attention to it because I've always lived my life the way my mother taught me to live it, which is that every day above ground is a good day. Don't look over your shoulder at society's rules or whether or not you please anybody else except you, because at the end of your life, right before they stick you underground, you can't go into the woulda, coulda, shoulda. You can't do that great Jewish joke. What's a great Jewish wine? I want to go to Palm Springs. Doesn't fly. You're responsible for your own happiness, and women have to get that notion over. Don't look to your guy. You have to figure out what makes you happy. And I did a long time ago. I'm an only child, and I had a lot of time to figure it out. And so what I figured out a long time ago was every day should be enjoyable. A, if you will, Epicurean hedonist. Look it up in your Funkin' Wagnalls. And what it means is life is the pursuit of pleasure, and I've done very well pursuing it. And so the band has been around 30 years. We're right behind the Beatles in the number of gold records by any groups in history. Somebody likes us. Women and their sisters and their moms seem to want to express their adoration and or fan worship, or perhaps they want to see if my oral appendage actually does have a spin and dry cycle and whether or not it has the ability to actually whip up a good froth. Ladies, I'm here to tell you it does. So for whatever reason they deem me worthy of their companionship, I was more than glad to oblige. And so almost 30 years ago, I started taking photos, Polaroids. And I still have them to this day. And so when the book was being written, Crown Publishers, who published my book, wanted to know, you know, you can't just say I did this and I did that. You've got to give specifics. So I sat down and started counting. One, two, and so on. And arrived at around 4,600 and change.
Mm-hmm. Are you interested in music, or is the goal of being in a rock band to have sex a lot?
I believe in my heart, that anybody who gets up there and says what they're doing is art is on crack and is delusional, and that in point of fact, what they really, their modus operandi initially, perhaps it changed when they started to question their sexuality, but clearly initially it was to get laid and make lots of money. And anybody who tells you otherwise is lying to you. The reason we all wanted to pick up instruments initially, you know, publicly anyway, I will grant you there are those people who really love music and simply want to do it as a private pleasure. The jury is out. I have no comment. But as soon as you get up publicly and want other people to hear it, it seems odd that we really get off on the notion that the opposite sex, the fairer sex, that's you, like what we do. And perhaps if we do it really well, you'll think, gee, he's not only talented and bright, but it's kind of cute, too. That's what we're hoping for, against all odds. And in music, it's the great aphrodisiac that says that even though I'm short, fat, ugly, bald, and I'm hung like a second grader, if I'm in a rock band, I've got a better than average chance of bedding you down than if I was a dentist. I didn't make those rules. I come from Israel. I'm simply a student at your feet. This is what I've noticed.
Are you interested in music at all?
Don't you love this interview? Tell me the truth.
Well, I think it's kind of a drag because you're making speeches and you're being intentionally
That's right.
obnoxious.
No, I'm not. I'm being a man.
That's what I mean. You're being intentionally obnoxious by defining everything that you're saying as
For me.
Being a man.
Well, I can't
I
talk.
I know better. I know all men.
No.
Defined by the way that you're speaking.
You're wrong. I always defined it as for me. I kept doing that over and over again. What bothers you is you're finally hearing a man tell the truth. Instead of, you're the only one I'll ever live with and you're the... He's lying. And I refuse to play that game. I refuse to stand up in front of a rabbi and my friends and the woman I love, who I will tell you I can love with all my heart, and promise that she's going to be the only one I will ever have until the day I die. That's a lie.
Do you like the movie Spinal Tap? And do you think that Spinal Tap has any comment on
rock and roll?
Like
sure.
This?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Sure. I think it's all funny. I mean, when you really think about it, I'm not delusional enough to think that what I do is important to life as we know it on this planet. No, but neither is what you do. You know, the world can get along very well without us. Farmers are more important, teachers and firemen and so on, because if they're not around, it really affects us. Your job and my job, whether you wear less makeup and I wear more makeup, is to entertain people. And I'm here to tell you, I'm very entertaining. I don't know about you, but this is NPR.
What exactly is NPR in your mind?
I never knew. It always sounds like a sixth grade school teacher. See, if I was in charge, give me the reins, I would get national public radio. People start snoring. I'm not questioning the content. You should have bright people on. Maybe you should never have me on again if you don't think I'm bright. Clearly, it should be a wonderful place for people who read and are bright to have a conversation, a discourse perhaps, without hearing whatever it is you hate about the outside world. Fine. How about some style? Give me a little spice instead of this bland. You ever see the Saturday Night Live version? It's pretty spot on.
Have you listened to it enough to know if it's spot on?
Sure. I was in Los Angeles and did a quick one. P.J. O'Rourke, who's great, who wrote for Rolling Stone, was on with myself and one other gentleman, I don't remember, and the DJ guy gets on, good afternoon, Gene, going, what's the matter, why are you talking like that? What do you mean? Going, you know what, let P.J. talk. P.J. the DJ, you need, as a listener, well, I would beg you guys to get something else on the air. Something with style. I change the call letters, NPR. I change it. Give it some oomph, Lexus, Locus, something. See?
Well, I'm going to get back to some questions about KISS, and we'll see where we get to. One of the things you've done on stage is your fire eating. How and why did you start doing that?
So that people can say, wow, look at him fire breathe, you know. Why does anybody... Why does a little boy put a frog in a little girl's hands? Because she screeches and goes, ah!
Did you learn from magicians how to do it?
Yes, I learned from a guy named Magico, who was actually you know, warned me about everything. And the first time I tried it, I burned the corner of my hair. And you know, it was very, very dangerous and continues to be.
What about throwing up blood? How did you consult a magician for that, too, or a special effects guy?
Nope. It's when nobody's looking, fill your mouth full of it and get into it. But what does it all mean? Nothing. It means for 2 hours, we're going to make you forget about the traffic jam and the fact that your girlfriend is whining or whatever else is going on in your life. And for 2 hours, we give you escapism. That's what it means.
What was the age of your audience when Kiss started to perform?
That's a good question, because in 1972 or 73, when we first started, it was late teens, and I'd say 18 to 20, 60 to 70% male. And then when Kiss became the number one band, you know, within a year and a half, we were playing Anaheim Stadium, and we had toys, games, comic books, everything you can imagine. The age really widened, and we had fans as young as 3 years old. And then through the 80s and stuff, the audience got older as we did less toys, less comic books, and so on. And now in the 90s, and of course through the 2000 era, we've got over 2,500 licenses. There's a Kiss Broadway play on the way with Rob Roth, who directed Beauty and the Beast, a Kiss cartoon show with the people who do Transformers and Beast Wars. In other words, there are Kiss comic books in the works. Superman meets Kiss. That's going to be the kickoff of the new Superman, rather the new Kiss comic book series. So we're going everywhere. I can be on the cover of Playboy magazine, and I can sell comic books and bubblegum to younger fans. And it's all good. And instead of being in a rock and roll band, who the hell wants to do that? I don't. I want to be in a rock and roll brand. I want to be Disney without the overhead. And I'm on the way.
Gene Simmons is the bass player of Kiss. His new memoir is called Kiss and Makeup. There's more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, The Lives of the Disabled, a work of nonfiction by Andrew Potok. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with Gene Simmons of Kiss. Also, we talk with Mark Weber, a young actor who stars in the new Todd Solondz movie Storytelling. Weber is the son of a homeless activist and was homeless himself during part of his childhood.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Gene Simmons, the bass player of KISS, the heavy metal band which he co-founded in the 70s. The band became famous for its shows. They painted their faces in black and white patterns and dressed in outrageous costumes. On stage, Simmons breathes fire, spits blood, and wags his long tongue. Simmons grew up in Israel and moved to Queens, New York, when he was 10. Let's talk about your background. You were born in Israel several years after the war ended. Your mother, during the war, was in a Nazi concentration camp. Do you have any memories of life in Israel?
I do. The German Nazi concentration camps during World War II, which the entire German population, or enough of it that you can say the German population, bought into hook, line, and sinker, was a result of my mother's and millions of other people's misery. And Israel was a strange place anyway. It was certainly not an easy place to go to. But 6 months after the, quote, independence of Israel, as recognized by the UN and who knows who else, I popped out. So where I was born was really an accident, just like everybody else. And growing up in Israel was sort of being in a box where you're not aware that the outside world exists. I certainly never saw a television set. I didn't know about Kleenex or supermarkets or anything. All I knew was you heard stories in school about David and Goliath and, you know, all these wonderful, great superheroic stories, and the sea is splitting open and wide, and our people go through it, and then it crashes again on the Egyptians, and, you know, all these great stories. And then slowly people started to tell me, no, this is the place that happened. You're actually living in it. So it was tough to take in. So at 8 and a half years of age, when I came over to America with my mother, it was like being thrown into another dimension. I had never heard of Santa Claus or Christ or Christmas, never knew anything about Christians or that there were other kinds of people. And from then on, I became a sponge. I wanted to just take it all in. It was just way beyond anything I could ever imagine. And television, the great television, and rock and roll and horror movies and science fiction and comic books were my education. And I thank God that those were what I learned instead of having to read Jane Eyre at an early age, because it wasn't anything I could relate to.
I know you went to a yeshiva as a boy. Were you from an Orthodox family?
No, nobody in the family was Orthodox, but when I came to America, my mother, being a single mother, had to go out and work from 6 in the morning till 7 at night, so she put me in a yeshiva, which is a Jewish theological seminary. In other words, you're studying to be somebody, and I was studying to be a rabbi. And they fed me and clothed me, and, you know, you sort of take care of your child. That way you don't have to worry that your child is on the street. And so while I was there, I saw one world, the closed world, and when I turned on television, people were flying through the air, and they had capes, and there were cartoons, and, you know, just amazing things, and I wanted to go there. I thought that was a lot cooler than yarmulkes.
What's your mother's reaction to KISS?
Well, it's interesting. Good question. My mother is probably the wisest person I've ever known. She's not schooled. She's not well-read. And yet she has a philosophy about life that makes well-read people seem like morons. She doesn't talk a lot, uses very few words to express herself, unlike myself, who likes the sound of his own voice. So here's a woman who'd been through the German Nazi concentration camps of World War II and still thought that there was goodness in humanity and thought about the fact that the glass was half full instead of half empty. And when asked about, well, what about your son? You know, he's in this weird rock band. He dresses weird and, you know, apparently has lots of liaisons and girls and stuff. What do you think about that? She goes, well, as long as he doesn't use drugs and alcohol and doesn't hurt anybody, I don't care about the rest. You know what? She's right.
Well, you've said that you don't use drugs, and you've
never
had a drink of alcohol.
That's not true. I've never been drunk.
You've never been drunk. That's right, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I literally, you know, at parties when somebody says toast, I try to take a sip, but without saying it for effect, It's true, when as soon as I smell alcohol, I start to gag. I may be blessed with some kind of chemical reaction against it, but I won't go near the most beautiful woman who's got my name written all over her. If she opens her mouth and smells like a truck driver who just drank Bud, I'm out of there, gone. It always struck me bizarre that women are willing to paint their mouths beautifully with lipstick and yet smoke and drink and make their breath smell like a garbage heap. So I can't do that. I can't be around people who numb their senses. Everybody's allowed, as far as I'm concerned, to take their own life or numb themselves to oblivion. I could care less. I have no sympathy for anybody who has the lives in America, especially, and who decides, you know what, I'm going to numb myself. Drugs, alcohol, cigarettes. So I'm happy to be alive every single day, and I want my senses working 24 hours a day. And if you were in my room and we were going to have a liaison and you were high, you'd be out on your butt before you could spell your last name. Because if you don't want to experience me with all the senses God gave you, you don't deserve to be with me.
You said you don't have sympathy for that guy on the roof who keeps saying I'm going to jump. My impression is you don't have much sympathy for anyone. You're so into yourself. You're just so deep into yourself.
I think everybody should be. If it sounds like admiration coming out of you, I accept it. I think life is too short to have anything but delusional notions about yourself, which is you should really like yourself more than you deserve to, because the alternative isn't very good. You should really think you are better looking than you are, because the alternative is sort of, you know, some bad notions. And so I'm aware, as a sane person, that I'm not the best looking guy in the world. I'm aware of it. But when I go into a party, I will walk out with your girlfriend.
Just one more question before we wrap up.
I
would like to think that the personality you've presented on our show today is a persona that you've affected as a member of KISS, something that you do on stage and before the microphone, but that you're not nearly as obnoxious in the privacy of your own home or when you're having dinner with friends.
Fair enough. And I'd like to think that the boring lady who's talking to me now is a lot sexier and more interesting than the one who's doing NPR, you know, studious and reserved. And I bet you're a lot of fun at a party.
Well, we'll leave it at that. Gene Simmons,
sure.
Thanks so much.
I look forward to our meeting.
Bye-bye. Gene Simmons is the bass player of KISS. His new memoir is called KISS and Makeup. Coming up, actor Mark Webber, star of the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. This is Fresh Air. At the age of 21, my guest Mark Webber has starred in the teen comedies Snow Day with Chevy Chase and Drive Me Crazy, and has appeared in the films The Animal Factory and The Boiler Room. He starred with W.H. Macy and Philip Baker Hall in the New York and London revivals of David Mamet's American Buffalo, and is in forthcoming films with Woody Allen and Al Pacino. Now he's starring in the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. He plays Scooby, a suburban high school kid who becomes the subject of a film documentary. In this scene, Scooby is talking with his guidance counselor about college. The guidance counselor has asked Scooby if he has any hobbies, reads books, or even comics. After Scooby answers no, the guidance counselor asks if Scooby has any long-term goals.
Well, I mean, I want to be on TV. Maybe have a talk show or something, like Conan or Early Letterman.
Aha. Uh-huh. How is it you hope to achieve this goal?
I don't know, see if I have any connections.
Mark Webber in a scene from Storytelling. Webber is from Philadelphia, where his mother is a homeless activist. They were homeless during part of his childhood. He was born in Minneapolis. His mother was 15.
We were on welfare. She got a grant to go to college, and she actually started going to college to become a teacher, a high school teacher. And slowly we started getting our stuff back together. We got an apartment. My mom had finished up college and started teaching at a local high school. in Minneapolis. And things were going great. We had this apartment, and then basically what happened was one day the state police walked into her classroom. She was teaching a women's studies class, and they arrested her for welfare fraud. Now, what happened was is she basically didn't report the grant money she was receiving to the welfare department to go to college. And the welfare system is set up where you literally, if you get a birthday card with $10 in it from a relative, you have to report that as income, and it's deducted from your welfare check. So basically, my mother was arrested in her school and got fired. Later, you know, went to trial for this case and it was dropped. But basically, the staff there just didn't hire her back. I guess it didn't look great for her to be arrested in front of her students.
And then what happened to you financially?
Well, basically, you know, my mom lost that job. And, you know, one thing just started leading to another. We, you know, weren't able to pay our rent. And we were served with an eviction notice, and then we lost our place. And we were then living in my mom's car for a while. I mean, it was just like that. And, you know, after my mother was fired, you know, she really had this revelation that she was going to dedicate her life to ending poverty and homelessness in this country and was going to make sure that no other women or children would have to go through what we went through.
When you were homeless in Minneapolis, did you live in shelters at all?
We, there was a few times that I stayed in a shelter, but it was some of the worst experiences of my life. I just didn't like the vibe of the place at all. And I just felt a lot safer and comfortable with just me and my mom out on the streets and taking over properties to live in.
When you were living in the car, what did you do for personal hygiene?
I had to become extremely creative. Had a lot of scope and a lot of cologne, literally. And, you know, that was one of the hardest parts about being homeless is that, you know, I still went to school and none of my friends knew. You know, I was so ashamed at the time, you know, and when you're, you know, 9, 10 years old and you're in grade school, it all comes down to, you know, what you have, what sneakers you have, what game systems you have, you know, how cool are you by, you know, the material things that you have, you know, and I, you know, felt like overnight went from a kid who had a place and then all of a sudden didn't.
So would you make up a lot of lies to tell your friends, or would you just decline to tell them what you were really doing?
I just made up so many lies. And actually, that's where a lot of my acting skills developed, I think. You know, and I was even lying to myself, I think, at some points. But no, I lied to all my friends. And then it became, you know, it was hard because I had to keep up with all the lies that I was telling.
What were some of your typical lies?
Well, you know, for the beginning part, you know, when buddies of mine who would regularly come over and stay at my place, you know, it was just that my mom was, like, really, really sick. And then, like, a couple weeks would go by, my friends were like, Mark, what's the deal? And I I kept going with that one for a while, which really sucked because, you know, I was pretending with my friends basically that my mother was like on her deathbed, you know, and I couldn't have anyone over. And it didn't feel great saying that.
Did it make you almost superstitious that it was as if you were courting that actually happening?
Yeah, totally. That's exactly what I had in my head.
When you moved to Philadelphia, you were living with your mother in a neighborhood that has a fair amount of crime and drug dealing. And I'm wondering if you were used to that after living in Minneapolis, and what it was like for you and your mother to be, well, for your mother to be organizing while you were taken with her in a neighborhood that could be pretty dangerous.
Oh, it was absolutely crazy. I was in no way used to it. Minneapolis to Philadelphia was major culture shock for me. I mean, I didn't realize I had an accent until I got to Philadelphia. You know, everyone was calling me farm boy. And it was intense. I mean, you had, you know, two ultra-white Midwesterners in North Philly walking around handing out flyers. And it was crazy. But, you know, again, it at the time, I mean, just all the other stuff that I had gone through prior to that, I guess had made it a little bit easier to deal with, but it was still very shocking. I mean, I'd never seen a neighborhood like North Philly ever before in my entire life.
What are some of the things you saw in that neighborhood that you hadn't seen before?
It just looked like a third world country to me. I mean, it literally looks like a bomb was dropped on the neighborhood. You know, tons and tons of boarded up abandoned buildings. You know, bunch of thugs out on the corner, people selling drugs right there in front of your face, people running up and asking you what you wanted, what you needed. You know, and just extreme poverty. You know, little kids running around. It was just wild.
Didn't you end up living in some of those boarded up houses?
Yeah. I mean, it's now a strategy and a tactic that we still use with our organization. You know, there in Philadelphia, I believe that there are more abandoned houses than there are actual homeless people, and you know, they're all, we take over federally owned properties, not privately owned properties, and we take off the boards, we clean it up, we make it presentable to the neighborhood, and we move these families in, and myself was one of them at times. And what ends up happening is we get arrested for trespassing, we get let out, we go right back in the house and get arrested again. And eventually through that process and drawing attention to the fact that these houses are lying here vacant and eventually become drug houses and things like that, we win them from the city.
My guest is actor Mark Weber. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Mark Weber. He's starring in the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. Weber's mother is a homeless activist in Philadelphia. They were homeless during part of his childhood, but he went to the city's high school for the creative and performing arts, where he realized he was serious about acting. Now, I think your first big break, either after high school or maybe when you were still in high school, was getting a TV commercial for Foot Locker.
Yeah.
I don't think I saw the commercial, and if I did, I didn't realize you're the one who was in it. So why don't you describe it?
Yeah, my first big break really was, you know, I came up to New York and I met this agent who is now my agent today, Abby Bluestone, and she sent me out on my first ever real deal audition in New York, and it was for Foot Locker, and it was actually with a friend of mine. Who'd also come up from Philly with me to New York. And we both went out on the commercial together, and we actually ended up, we were paired together to go in and meet the producers in the audition. And the audition was, we had to stand there and talk about sneakers. And now sneakers, that's like my one vice. Like, I am a sneaker fiend. I'm obsessed with sneakers, and I love them. And so I just went off, and my friend totally went off too, and we were kicking all types of slang, and we blew them away. And we left, and I got a pager on my little pager, and I called back, and I found out that we got the commercial, and I flipped out. I mean, it was the first thing that we were sent out on in New York, and now we showed the agents that we meant business and that we could do it, and it was crazy. I had to figure out a place to stay up here, and because it was shooting in a couple days, and I didn't have enough money to go back to Philly and then come back up, so we had to get a place to stay up here, and we stayed with a friend of mine, and we both got picked up in the morning, and we went down and we shot this Foot Locker commercial, and it was wild.
And what was the after effects of that?
Well, basically, you know, the commercial went great, you know, and, you know, I just started getting sent out on a whole lot more stuff. You know, then I started getting sent out on a bunch of commercials. And I didn't really book any more commercials after that, but my feedback was really well, and it was really good. And I was able to, you know, develop more of a friendship and a relationship with my agent, and I let her know that I was really interested in doing films, and then the whole film thing started picking up. So from that one commercial, everything just kind of, you know, one thing led to another.
And you've been in several movies, and you were with, you played Chevy Chase's son in Snow Days. You were in Animal Factory, an independent film directed by Steve Buscemi, a teenage film called Drive Me Crazy. Now you're in Storytelling, which is directed by Todd Solondz. John Goodman plays your father in this one. And you also worked on stage in London and in New York in a version of David Mamet's play American Buffalo. And you starred with W.H. Macy and Philip Baker Hall. I mean, two really great actors. I guess I'm interested in that experience of being on stage with two great actors who aren't the biggest stars in the world, but, I mean, they're wonderful. And you have David Mamet dialogue. And,
yeah.
And how old were you when you got it? Like 20 or something?
Yeah. It was absolutely amazing. I mean, it was life-changing, definitely. I mean, Bill Macy, I mean, you know, grew up with Mamet, and they were buddies, and he played my role of Bobby the very first time that American Buffalo was ever done. So, you know, you talk about a guy who knows Mamet, and especially knows American Buffalo, and knows the ins and outs of all the characters. I mean, it was him. So, I mean, it was intense. I mean, it was my first time ever reading Mamet, and I really didn't know about the kind of particular style that he has and that he teaches until I had got involved with the play and had, you know, met Bill. So I really learned a lot. And really, I guess what I learned most was, it's not something really that I learned, but something that just, that Bill really defined for me was that, you know, it's always, always, always about being in the moment and being as truthful as possible. And, that really resonated inside my head when he said that to me, because, I found it was something that I was already kind of doing, but just hearing it put into those words, especially just being in the moment, really hit me, because I think it's so important. I think it's really hard for actors to kind of listen to one another, especially when you're doing a film. And I was always accustomed to, you know, when I first did my first movie, I'd, you know, read a line and practice saying a line a certain way, practice it and practice it and practice it by myself, and then show up on set after waiting for like 10 hours, meeting the person I'm going to do the scene with for the first time right before we shoot it, and then go and like trying to do my lines the way I practice saying it, and they try and do theirs the way they said it. It doesn't work. There's no chemistry. There's no connection in the scene. So it was really just about being in the moment. And when you do stage, I mean, you're forced to have to be in the moment. Every single second.
I know when you were young, you really wanted to live the life of a star, and you're on your way to achieving that. But I wonder how all the trappings of stardom and Hollywood look to you after growing up poor, sometimes homeless, and having a mother who is still a homeless rights and welfare rights activist.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really an almost absurd contrast.
It really is. And, you know, I got to tell you, I wake up every morning, and I feel like the luckiest guy on earth. And all that I've gone through in my entire life, you know, being homeless and being raised poor and struggling and coming from a place of struggle has totally given me the upper hand in this industry. And I feel that every day when I go and audition and when I meet executives and when I go and meet fellow actors and movie stars. It's a great feeling, actually. I almost feel like I walk into every room and I feel like I have the upper hand.
Why?
Because for as much as I love acting and it's my passion and it's my dream, I really don't care about being famous. I really don't care about being rich. I had the most amazing woman in the entire world who really showed me that material items really don't mean anything and that everybody should have, you know, basic human rights and that. And now, you know, it's like all this success is really bittersweet because it's a weird thing, you know. I really truly want everyone to have what I have or to be able to have the experiences that I have. You know, I really believe that everyone should have housing and should have food and clothing and health care.
Have you offered to buy your mother a house, and is that something that she would accept?
She would probably accept a maybe slightly nicer house in North Philly, but that's it. I'm not at the point now to be able to buy her a home. And when I do get to that point, you know, she'd never leave North Philly. That's her home, and that's where her friends are, and she'll never leave there.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Mark Webber is starring in the new film Storytelling. Tomorrow we'll meet the director of the film, Todd Solondz. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Todd Solondz, the director of Welcome to the Dollhouse, Happiness, and the new film Storytelling. And we talk with one of the stars of Storytelling, Paul Giamatti. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.